Sure.
Testing. Testing.
Go ahead.
Testing.
Yeah, we're good. We are great. So I'll glance down here every
sure,
once
that's
in a while.
All right.
I'm going to start out with something that's really, really easy. It's probably the easiest question of the batch.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is I'd like you to please say your first and last name
mm-hmm.
and your maiden name and spell last name and maiden name, please.
Mm-hmm. Margaret Alice Gay. Want me to spell the whole thing?
Margaret
just
is M-A-R...
G-A-R-E-T-A
mm-hmm.
letter, Gay, G-A-Y.
Mm-hmm.
No E on it.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. And you were serving, you did a career in the Navy.
I made the Navy my career, right.
Let's go ahead and start, rather than like at
mm-hmm.
the beginning, because you were showing me some pictures of you when you were 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in Boston?
I grew up I was adopted, and so I had Worcester, Massachusetts, and Auburn, Massachusetts, and then I was born in Boston.
You were born in
Boston?
Born in Boston. And then were taken back.
Right, were adopted and lived in Worcester and Auburn. I went to school in Auburn.
What did your family do?
My family,
yeah.
Well, the people that adopted me, he was a stonecutter. And they lived in Vermont at that time. And then he passed away when I was 4 years old. And then my mother came down to her sister, her sister had passed away in May and left her husband. And they used to take foster children. And he had one foster child. So it combined to put the two families together to make it. She was a help for him to take care of it was one of those
mm-hmm.
joint affairs. It wasn't a marriage or anything. It was just that. And so that's where I went, and I started, the first grade in Worcester, Massachusetts, and then my mother remarried, and when I was 7 years old, and then we moved from Worcester to Auburn, which was a suburb of Worcester. And I did all my grades, other than the first grade that I had started, in Worcester, I did through high school in Auburn.
In Auburn.
Mm-hmm.
When
grammar school and high school.
When your family moved down, when your mother moved down, had the depression already hit by that point?
Oh no, this was only when she moved down. I was only five years old, between 5 and 6.
Okay.
So see, that was just 1925 and 26.
No, I just asked because
yeah,
I
right,
a lot of
yeah,
families
no,
in the depression.
No, our depression. Oh no, yeah, that's.
Moved in
together. Mucho later.
Yeah,
stepfather then.
Yes.
And I had another father. See, that's I collected fathers.
Wait, so how many fathers
no,
did
I was
going to
say. Well, I had the original one, and then I had the foster father and then the stepfather.
Ah, okay.
They call the adopted ones them foster fathers. Now I guess they call them stepfathers. But
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so your mother remarried and you guys moved to
Went to Auburn.
Auburn,
right, and that's where I went to school. And she married, which was my stepfather, Mr. King, and he had been in the he was in World War I. See, he was a cavalry guy with Patton and World War I guy. See, and so what you're going to ask me? I noticed one of your questions on your little sheet there is, why you joined the Navy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, but I was always fascinated with the Navy as a kid growing up. I always wanted Navy midi blouses, and so then when the World War II came along and that because I'd heard all about all the army, both the cavalry and the army, and I wanted something new in the family. See, give a little spice to it. But unfortunately, I went in the Navy and went in and away from home. It was just I was the only child, so I was the only child, which put a big hole in the family because it was just the two of them. And that made a big difference. And my father got transferred home because my mother was sick, but it ended up that I was home and only home 4 days, and my father died. See, so
oh, wow.
Stepfather. So it was one of those quick things that happened now and then.
What did he die of?
Oh, he died. He just died of his old heart gave out. He was a typical old soldier. He went once a year for his annual physical. He didn't believe in them, but he went every year because that was the thing in the army. These things we pick up in the service, you do it all your life if you spend enough time in there. You'll notice I have some habits of that. And then he went up for his annual physical, and they put him in the hospital and died 4 days later.
Wow.
But he was a man that walked every day. Did, you know, he walked the dog. He was a walker, did his exercise and everything. It was just, you know, well, just wore out.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a railroad man, was his, you know, from the Army he became. And he was here in San Francisco at the earthquake. He was between enlistments again. Mm-hmm. He got re-enlisted quick.
Yeah, I would think so. That would have been a pretty scary.
He said that was one, you know, and there was no reason not to re-enlist on that. So I get all the stories of the San Francisco earthquake. See,
it all kind of starts to tie together. Did you, you said he had a different last name.
King, yes.
Gay the name of your father?
No, Gay was the name of my foster father. No, I had my name on the birth certificate was Lyons, and then when they adopted, they had a change of name to
Gay.
To Gay, right, mm-hmm. From Lyons to Gay. Grace Lyons to Margaret. And I was named after my foster mother's sister, Margaret, see, the one that she came down to make the family with.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So they completely, changed your name.
She named me after her, so.
Was your childhood, did you have a happy childhood?
I had a very happy childhood. My mother was, as a matter of fact, we were discussing it this morning where that woman just had twins at 60 years old, terrible. Now, I was only 18 months old when I was adopted, and both my mother and father were 40 and 41. And in that era, that was old to take an 18-month-old. So there was always, a different generation, you know, just like now. Mm-hmm. So, and my mother was very strict, but I thank her for it, because I was, when you adopt kids, you never know what you're getting, see? And I was a little on the wild side. And yet my normal, biological mother was a pussycat, you know, I would have ran all over her.
Did you end up knowing her?
Yes, later I looked her up. The lady that adopted me was, I get very annoyed at these people on television that you hear, people that they're adopted and their mother gave them up, and they and they go rave on. The first thing they should do is just say, thank you, I've had life, I've had 86 years. Regardless of how or why or what, you mm-hmm. weren't there, you weren't in their shoes, you don't know. Just be glad they gave you life. Mm-hmm. You don't get it now. A lot of them get, you know.
Yeah.
It's too bad. No, my mother, who I call my mother, the foster lady, my mother, she was very, was not the type she wanted. She didn't know much about the adoption because her sister Margaret's dear friend that lived in Boston knew my biological mother's family, and they knew they had this. I was illegitimate, so they had, you know, got to put you somewhere.
And that was
I was born in the orphanage and adopted from the orphanage, St. Margaret's Orphanage, which all Margaret worked my life period, whether they wanted it or not. I don't think my mother ever thought of that. I just thought of that too. I'm 86, and that's the first time I put the two together. Isn't it funny?
Very much
it was hard on them, you know. And then, like I say, I was adopted 18 months, and my father, God, I loved him, 4 years old. He, my birthday is on the 18th, and he September, and he died on the 24th. I was four on the 18th of September, and see, I was only 4 years old when he died. Stone cutter, he was a stone cutter, and you know.
And what did that,
he died of, you know, the tuberculosis then. You know, they didn't have these titles to things. It probably was cancer of the lungs, and they just called it, you know, stone cutters.
Because he had the cough. And
Had all the...
Yeah.
Well, and they didn't have MRIs and all, you know.
All the fancy stuff we
had
now.
Yeah, but I was sorry that he didn't, because he was wonderful.
Yeah, that's, I mean...
So I always kept his name, and now Mr. King, which, you know, was the one my mother married him when I was seven there. But, and he was great too. He should have had a parcel of kids. He loved kids. But I never, and he didn't want me either. He knew I didn't want him to adopt me. So.
So he respected the wishes of a 7-year-old.
Right. It was, as far as I was concerned, he was like an adopted father. I was adopted, but not changed my name. Mm-hmm. No, he didn't adopt me, and it was fine.
So you went to high school?
Went to high school, right.
There.
I went to high school, and because when I got out of high, I graduated in 1939, of course, you're in the midst of the Depression, and I went to where I lived in Auburn, which was a small town. I went into Worcester and joined the NYA National Youth, you know, WPA National Youth. And it's funny because my mother was a sewer and terrific, but I never learned, didn't learn to sew, see. And the job I got put in a factory making sewing kids' clothes, baby clothes. It's going to get you one way or the other.
Oh, dear.
But anyway, that's so I went to the NYA, and then they wanted to, the city was transferring, well, I was not, didn't belong in the factory sewing, so, because I had a commercial course, so I, you know, I went down to City Hall and said to the lady, you know, isn't there something commercially, because I want to get experience in my field rather than, sure, so then what it is, they signed to schools to help the principals, little clerical stuff as well. So that's what I went from the sewing factory to the principal of a over in the best, one of the best schools in Worcester over on the side. And for the principal, you know, you went around and collected the chocolate milk money and took all this, you know. It was a terrific job. But then, you know, I knew I needed, I'm got to advance. And so then along came, and they were looking the same, still on the NYA. They were looking for, they needed someone to go to the state hospital, the mental hospital. And it was to go in the treasurer's office. So, boy. So I went, that's where I finally got into something I was doing in the accounting field with bookkeeping, I stayed there. And then I knew you can only, at that time, I was only, as a matter of fact, they shouldn't have hired me because I wasn't, not supposed to hire until you're 21. I was still 20. But I needed to get into the, out in industry. So I finally got a job. I went to accounting school at night, and there was another gal in the class, and she was working for a wholesale grocer and liquor company in Worcester. And so she said one night, she said, you know, there's going to be an opening. You might be interested. So having known her, really was when I went to be interviewed by the boss there, and of course she had said she knew me and whatnot. So, and he was an accountant. So, so then I went to work for the wholesale grocery liquor company, and then I joined the Navy from there.
Now, when you said you went through a commercial course, is that like going?
I went to Northeastern University. Their night accounting school was at the YMCA in Worcester, but I went there at night and. Started the course, and then when I went to work with the wholesale grocer, the boss was he was a CPA himself, and so he was going to teach me accounting. I was faster than I was learning it there, so I figured the job training of accounting and whatnot. And as a matter of fact, his method was: if you want to really be an accountant, you got to know how to pad the books. That's how you learn accounting. Learn, you know, that's how you find the things out, because you learn all the crooked stuff, you know, the right stuff.
Interesting.
So he was more into, because the guy put you asleep at night. Accounting is not an easy thing to teach, you know, So he was given on a lot of, taught me a lot. So then.
But he wasn't doing anything illegal. He was.
He was a CPA, his method, his teaching method. If he was going to be a teacher, that's how he'd teach you to milk the books.
How funny. Was there, you said you went from high school and you started working. Was there the assumption that you would be working, or why did you decide to go out to work?
Well, I wasn't one that, I was not interested in getting married, so I wouldn't, you had to go to work. You need, you just couldn't, you know, sit around and eat on your family. Then, you know, you got most of the gals, they either went to in Depression days, for the women, you know, you went to be a sales clerk, because that had been the thing for women before, teachers or sales clerk. Well, it was a sales clerk or bank tellers and insurance companies, a lot of insurance companies in Madison, and they nabbed low-paying jobs. Those were low-paying jobs, but they were jobs if you could get them.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
It doesn't sound like you had a hard time getting work, though.
No, I was lucky. See, at that time I went around and applied in a lot of places before I got this You know, when the girl told me that night, I'd already been putting my name in and been interviewed. But two, I didn't have any experience. And of course, most of the companies that were hiring that needed to hire someone, they needed someone with an experience. See, so this company was glad enough to. And like I say, with working with her, the boss there, the CPA, he knew I could handle the bookkeeping type of thing I had there. And I worked myself up to credit manager there before I left there to go in the Navy.
How long were you there?
I was, I went there, I go back now, 40 to 42.
Wow.
Late 40, 41 to 42.
It's a long time.
Yeah, a couple of years.
Yeah, it's a long time. So while you're there, that's when that's when the Pearl Harbor attack happened in the midst of all this.
In 41. Yes, and well, the thing, you know, we weren't at war, but, you know, like your friends, the most of the guys you went with were in the reserve, the National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
Those things were becoming active, you know, because we were, didn't pay attention at that time. You didn't know that Roosevelt was helping England, and that, you know, you were really half in the war before you got in it. You know, we were. So, see, things were more active. And of course, my stepfather there, you know, he being the old veterans, they used to go down every day he went down because he, to the Depression, he was out of work, railroad. He'd lost his job there, and so he was just, living on his limited pension. But, and of course, they were keeping up on things, you know, the military things. And then, like I say, I told you I was always sort of like the Navy. There's something about the Navy I liked as a kid. And then when in the newspaper, and it wasn't on the first page, it was on the second page, just a little thing when they, you know, they were having, that the waves had come in. I knew about the WACs because one of my girlfriends, I went down to Springfield with her. You know, and I wanted the Army. I had that in the back of my mind. If it's good, the Navy will have it, see. Then she joined the WACs. So she went that day, and then she joined, see. And I said, well, if it's good, the Navy will have it. And so I waited, see. Well, it was from May until, see, it took that long before they didn't pass our bill until the 30th of June.
I think part of the struggle was, when I was reading in the histories, is that they didn't want it to be an auxiliary.
The ones in the Navy fought it, which her book is interesting to read because she fought for a lot of the stuff, and a lot of stuff that she doesn't have in there. We know that it was a man's Navy. It was not easy at their level. The officers had a hard row too to haul, and of course, and we did. But of course, I think what probably made it easier for us too, because a lot of the fellow enlisted people that were in, they were in the same boat you were in. They didn't know any more about the Navy than you did, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
A few of the ones that were in, but see, they were a small group. Because now I can remember, before I even joined the Navy or thinking of coming in, there was a guy lived up the street from me. Every Monday night, he went down, because in his uniform, went to the reserve. See, he was at that time, and that was in 39 and 40, you know. And see, now, so when he went in, he was raided. So, like, when my fellow classmates went in the Navy, they might have worked for him, and he was raided, but because he'd been in the reserve, see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But see, the men's attitude was completely different then, too, you know, because the families were larger. There were brothers and sisters, and, you know, the boys were brought up to take care of your sister if you had. I didn't. I was the only one in the family, but I know the girl, they talk about it, and we didn't have the problem. They had a few bad things happen, but you're bound to have a few, but they didn't have the problem that they've had, you know, these later years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes they get a little loaded and whatnot, but you said no was no. And if you got one that was a little too active, you know, you just gave them the... Anyway, it solved the problem fast. But see, starting in 50, just in the chow line, when the guys would make a quick remark to them, the gals would go, oh, big deal about it, get mad and everything. So, no, you just give it back to them nicely, you know. They didn't know how to... Well, it's just like the kids today, they don't know how to fist fight, they got to shoot with guns.
Yeah.
See? Except now they got that crazy thing, what They're boxing. That the latest thing out, the kids, the teenage kids, they're boxing. They're hitting one, each one in the head until one of them either gives up or passes out.
Look at that. Yeah, extreme fighting sort of thing, yeah.
Well, no, this is a special thing. This isn't street fighting. This, no, they don't sell those on the street. This is just something they've taken up to be.
Weird.
Like the time they remember, well, back they were using that choking thing.
Yeah. So let's go back a little bit because we kind of like jumped ahead and we missed a bunch of stuff.
I probably talk too much.
No, I want you to talk a lot. Don't worry. That's a good thing.
I'm a talker.
No, that's a good thing.
And it's a good thing if I'd had a couple of drinks, I'd talk more. Can't take it because you're on medication.
So you went down with your girlfriend and she joined the army.
She went in the army, right.
Was there any other reason besides the fact that you were kind of intrigued by the Navy? Were there any other factors that led you to decide to join in the Navy rather than the Army or the Coast Guard or the Marines?
No, well, no. So don't forget, you couldn't go join the Coast Guard and Marines. See,
because they were ahead of the
yeah. When I get into, see, when we went to the three schools, that's open, see, so much of the things, even her book, is so much of it just deals on 1943 and 44 when they opened Hunter. But see, they forget those first three schools that opened in October. There was your crop. And they asked, see, as a matter of fact, there were the four people you sat together on the train going to Bloomington. Two of those girls there joined the Coast Guard. They asked us people to volunteer to go into the Coast Guard. See, and that's how the Coast Guard started. And they did that in November and December. And then December and January, they were asking into 43, asking for people to join the Marines, to start the Marines.
Yeah, that's right, because they started...
But see, that's where they started. Hunter didn't start everything. Hunter was the first... See, Hunter was the first big, real boot camp. They had a small one at Cedar Falls, but Hunter was the big one, because we had our boot at each one of the universities.
And where did you go again?
I went to... The storekeepers went to Bloomington University of Indiana. As a matter of fact, how things are fast and the Navy was working, some of the people in California here that were going to be storekeepers... They had orders to the Stillwater where the yeoman ended up, and they decided at the last minute for some reason to make the storekeepers in Indiana and the yeoman, and so they had to, you know, tut on the train and tell them that their orders to go.
And they had to go someplace different.
Yeah, well, they had to, yeah, to just, you know,
wow.
Get off in Oklahoma, rerouted them in charge.
How did you get assigned to storekeeper school? Because I know the women that I talked to Hunter...
Yeah,
they went to boot camp then.
First,
they
right. Okay, well, see, that's the difference of when we went in the service, why we went in the service. Number one, the war had started, Pearl Harbor. And, you know, that threw you when you heard that. You were shocked at that and couldn't believe it. And so, one of your things, what did you do before that? We were air raid wardens. I was an air raid warden first, and then when you went in the service. But we had to bring something to the service. I was a bookkeeper, an accountant. And like the first officers, most of them were teachers. See, you brought something to the Navy, and they didn't have to teach you right off. They did have to take us accountants and teach us Navy accounting. So you went to storekeeper school or Navy accounting, and communicators went to Madison, Wisconsin. That's where their radio men came out of, and the yeoman to Stillwater. The secretaries to learn Navy correspondence and lingo.
But, I mean, they also had to do some basic Navy indoctrination.
Like we had the boot camp training, identification planes, all the regular stuff that you have today in your basic training at boot camp, which later when I went to push boots, that's what, you know.
You did.
Yeah. So, but see that, well, yes, you had the Navy orientation. You were out there every morning doing the calisthenics, and you're doing the marching. And as a matter of fact, we had, at Bloomington, the fleet came in, sailors to go to storekeeping school too. And they were in from the fleet, the fighting fleet. These were guys from the Pacific then that had been, see, this was 42, and these guys had been out there 41, and they wanted them to get, teach them, they needed storekeepers, trained storekeepers. So they got transferred in, and we had male chiefs teaching us the Navy lingo, the Navy courses, things. The university professors taught you the Navy accounting. They had to learn the Navy accounting, but in Bloomington had you if I'd got out of the Navy, you know, at the end of the war, I could have applied and been taken in as a sophomore at the University of Indiana. They give you the freshman year because of the course that they set up, equivalent they felt was equivalent to a freshman intelligence level, I guess.
Wow.
They were very. It was a terrific. That was a terrific university.
Yeah.
And it was it's outstanding because they had those of us from the East Coast that had been to New York and to the radio center, they had a building there. Then it was because the limestone they had there, they had a complete replica of.
Wow.
Yeah, they're
of like Radio City Music Hall.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
They had a lot of now I can't remember the violinist that came there, and oh, you had while we were there, you know, their university was very active and had a lot of. But I'm saying they used their limestone, and they, mm-hmm. They did.
Was it a hard adjustment for you?
No, because like I told you, my mother was a strict disciplinarian. So as a matter of fact, they didn't think I'd probably make it, you know, because I guess they figured that it would be, or my father, I think it was my father wasn't too sure that I'd adhere to it. My mother now was not. In favor of this, you know.
She wasn't.
Well, no, see, she, her era of women, you know, she's such a troop follower, you know. No. No, that square, that door, when you went through that, I went.
So she was afraid that because you were joining, it would be more like you were there to meet guys,
yeah,
and to serve.
Well, camp followers for her generation, what they thought, yeah. Right, so you know, Foot Locker went, and I went, and that was it. And I wrote a letter home every week, you know, just the same. Even though I didn't get any, but I'd get an envelope full of stuff that came for me in the mail. You know, she'd mail it to me and whatnot. And
but she wasn't writing to you.
No. But but my father, I'd write, and he'd read the letters and pick them. And he knew she read them. But anyway, you know. But anyway, Christmas. I think this is going to be. It didn't bother me that much. I knew that eventually she'd come around. I was pretty sure she would. Anyway, I get this box at Christmas. I'm thinking, oh, I wonder what this is. You know, surprise. My favorite cookies, Toll House cookies. You know, they were invented in our neck of the woods. They're real, and I'd always wanted a signet ring. And I had the signet ring and the Toll House cookies. No Christmas card, no nothing, but I bet.
So that was a signal to you that...
Well, that, you know, I said, well, at least... So then, see, that was Christmas, but we didn't finish up until January. And we left Bloomington on the 1st of February. And then we had leave before I was to report to Cleveland. And so my other Boston friends, when we went on the train going home, I said, well, the train went to Worcester first, where I was going to get off, and my Boston friend said, well, if I don't have a bed tonight, I'll be down. And then they said, yeah, well, we're going to have one for you, you know. But anyway, no, it worked out all right.
What was your mom's reaction when you came home?
Oh, it was good. And later, you know, she had to admit later it was a good move, but it was a hard move to admit it.
Well, you know,
But I could understand it.
Yeah.
See, I knew. I mean, like I say, I knew she was strict, and I knew the old generation. You know, I had figured that out pretty good. You know, things were different. Each generation, you know, they figured we were going to hell in a basket, just like we figured they are today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's time. You must move on.
Was it hard for you to make the decision to join because your mother?
Well, yes, it was. I didn't want. I did that because I knew she wasn't in the best of health, and then, but as my father, she was the one that was in poor health at that time, and she'd had a lot. She'd had 11 operations in her life. Of course, 5 of them were operations, and 6 of them were adhesions because the way they treated people in those days. But and she wasn't in the best of health, and then you know, and I thought. Yeah, but as my father said to me, there's no use of you looking at it that way. You have to live your life. You could stay here, and you could be here 10 years before anything would happen to her. So he said, you have to make up your own mind.
Why the military? Why not do something else? I mean, there were a lot of other different options.
Oh, I know,
no,
but that's Oh no, that was that they offered they of the Navy is going to take women, you know, with my little favorite Navy there. Oh, I had midi blouses. I had the hats growing up as a kid, you know.
So there was never even a, it was never like, you wouldn't think to go to work, say maybe work in a factory and be a Rosie the Riveter.
Oh, not when I had, no, not when that's going to be, no, I wouldn't have anyway come the war, even if, well, I was working in a, that, but come the war you want to do, you know, I'm air raid warden and I wanted to, plus don't forget we knew what was going on in Europe and the gals over there, the ambulance drivers and the, you know, figuring, Elizabeth there was running the ambulance around, and at that time we figured, well, if she's running around the ambulance, I guess
yeah. You can do the same thing.
Yeah, we better do something.
So you were assigned to Cleveland.
No, I was you went to Bloomington to learn your storekeeping and was assigned to Cleveland. And the reason Cleveland opened is because the Bureau of Supplies and Accounts, which was the one that sent out all the allotments to the wives and mothers and whatnot, is they were running out of civilian help in Washington. They couldn't get the help. So they moved the Bureau of Supplies and Accounts to Cleveland because they had all that extra help. And plus they didn't have the problem there too, only they never said that, but they see they could hire the Negro people, which see Washington, they had some in there, but I mean they weren't that educated, some, so the ones that were, but they had this big market to get civilians. And as a matter of fact, the first section I worked in, it was funny because the civilian supervisor was a Southern girl, and she volunteered, like when they sent, she had five colored girls working in our section. It was the five colored girls, me and her. But she, you know, she, and later when I ran the barracks and the first Negro girls were coming over, I knew I was going to have to find Bell's phone. But it always fascinated me, too, because the first girls that came down and said, "Hey, Maggie, I'll take a roommate," were always Southern girls.
Interesting.
I had the ones all volunteered, the other ones I needed, and then I only had to look for a couple that, you know, that no one had volunteered to take. You know, I mean the Southern.
Like, this was like in 45 when they started letting the African girls into the African American girls into the military, or was this before?
Well, no, they were in before, but I was talking about the civilians at that time.
Civilians. Yeah. Okay.
At that time, but no, in the Navy when I had running the barracks, because that was 1950. That's
okay. So it was like they were in. Yeah.
But you know, see why it struck me so was having not see that there were not that many Negroes in my section of the country. As a matter of fact. When the first the Catholic school I went to first, there was only one girl sat across from me, and only one Negro girl in the whole school. See, so then, and you know, to me that was fascinating. Different color, you know, you didn't against them, you were for them, you know. So and then when I went to Washington later, you know, and found out worked there in the Pentagon, and you know, I'm working with we're working with them all along, and then. On Saturday, you're down at Woodruff's doing your shopping and whatnot, and you run into them. You know, they're doing their shopping. And hey, let's go have a cup of coffee. You couldn't go have a cup of coffee with them. But we'd had coffee every day at the thing. And so when, like I say, so I was startled when, as a master at arms of the barracks, that these girls came forward and asked for a roommate. And I'm thinking, well, this is...
I know. I talked to one of the women that I talked to on the cruise was from... she's African American, and she's from New York City area, New Jersey. Anyway, she said that when she served during World War II, and she said that they made sure to place them in northern cities because they were worried
more
about
accepted.
This,
yeah,
they were worried about segregation.
Uh-huh.
Really,
but
worried.
See, you know, in Washington, you think you didn't think of all places. Yeah, there would have been no problem. Yeah, and it was kind of rough on them too. But
this was in the '50s that you're talking about, right? When you were.
Well, I was master at arms. It was 1952. 50. Yeah, okay. Right now, 51.
So, did you discover? Did you when you took your first assignment? It doesn't sound like. I mean, I know you know one of the slogans was "Free a man to fight," but it doesn't sound like.
Oh yes. Oh, the first guy I sent to sea was a panic, in the Bureau of Supplies and Accounts.
Really?
See, like I told you, these allotments. You signed, the sailor signed his allotments, and they had a card and sent in the office. I had to sign it, and they were these long transmittal letters, and they were five copies, all colored copies, you know, and they had to have a number on them. And so the jobs were not that fascinating. They were very monotonous. But anyway, the first sailor, he's going to break me on a job, and he had all these stacked up here, and so, and he wasn't in no great rush in the morning, but he had them all stacked up nice and done, and he had the numbering machine, and he pushed down that, and then that's fine. Took that one off there. Now we got to separate the colors. It was a panic. Well, anyway, he went to sea, and when he came in the Navy, the day he came in the Navy, he was from New York, up in New York State. See, during the war, those early years of the war, the recruiting officers, you went down, and whatever they needed, the Navy needed, they needed a bunch of first-class yeomen. The day he went to that recruiting office. So they made him a first-class yeoman. He hadn't had boot camp. He didn't know what a yeoman was from a street cleaner. But he was made a yeoman, see. And he ended up out with the storekeepers in the Bureau of Supplies and Accounts. But then when he went to sea, he hadn't had any boot training. Anyway, he'd write these letters. Oh, God, he had cramps in his legs. They were killing him because those ladders are not... You know, it ain't like stairs. You go up even the steepest stairs, like... The houses in Vermont, those early houses were kind of straight to what they are now. But these are even worse, you know. And he was complaining of the cramps in his legs. But anyway, when he went to be a yeoman, see, they asked him, you know, and you know where he worked? He worked in Sing Sing. And then he went from Sing Sing down to the recruiting office, and they needed a first-class yeoman. And can you type? He can type, right. He could type. But it was funny.
Was there any resentment?
No. What was funny, see, now in Cleveland, we had a number of men there, naturally, and then the thing had come out, someone was going to be sent to sea. They needed some, and then everybody, the guy, in between times, these guys said, well, I want to get rid of this job. I'd rather go to sea, you know. I want to go out there and fight, you know, until the list came out, and they were afraid they'd be on the list. Anyway, no, there was no resentment. No, we didn't have the... I didn't run into any, I can say in all the time I was in the service, I had no problem with the sailors I worked with. And later, you know, I went to yeoman. When I came back to change my rate from storekeeper to yeoman, I was the only girl in the class, the only woman in the class. No, I never had any problem with them, you know. I knew men in media, they needed their time to themselves, and, you know, and if you treat people right, they treat you right. And I had a lot of fun with them, and... No problems.
I just, you know, I've heard stories or read, you know, about times when, you know, when especially in those early classes, there was some of the old Navy guys were like kind of suspicious that women could be a part of the job. But
oh well, probably some of them did. Yeah, right. I'm sure, but I didn't. I had no problem. I never had any problem where I was. Whether if they did, I never saw it. Didn't.
Wow.
They never showed it. So, but oh, I'm sure there was places. Because it was a man's Navy, you know, you knew
it
that.
It was a big change.
You went like that. I went with that attitude, knowing that it was a man's Navy, and that I was just there to do a job, and I'd do the job the best I could. We made damn sure we did it to the best of our ability, a little better sometimes, because we knew they'd be watching you, you know, and and you. But I can really say I had no problems. Couple little things, but nothing that not resentment or anything, you know.
Mm-hmm. What sort of things? You said a couple little things. What were those?
Well, you know, a different section. I can't even remember whatever started with one of them anyway. But you always run into them later. See, you're not gonna better not too. See, you knew you could go just so far. You know, and you go over that line, and then you're into the discipline status. No, I can't really complain about any of it.
Did you stay in the same office during World War II, or did you end up getting transferred?
Oh no, I got transferred. I was in Cleveland. I had to get a humanitarian transfer home on account of my mother. So I left Cleveland, went to Cleveland, and then I went to when I went to Boston, I went to work at the section base, which was the small craft that went out, and they were the ones that used to. Take those small ships, and they used to take the guys from Harvard and MIT, the officers that were there, so they would go out with the get a little, and the poor guy, you felt bad, because that North Atlantic in the winter is terrible. They go out in the morning, they come back green, you know. But the section base was so, I went there as second class, which was unusual. See, there again, too, there was only one other guy that was one of the reserves that I told you about, like the one that went before I joined the Navy. The first class guy had been a reserve, you know, since 1938. And see, he was the first class one, and then here it gone in, and then, and I was the second class. And it was a little, I think the girls felt it more that my coming in as second class, and they were all third class and seamen and trying to make. But
so there was a little
there was a little more between the women that one time, but it didn't, you know, it was just they. But you settle that down. You just ignore some things and they
go away.
Yeah.
Did you when you were serving? Did you end up you ended up staying on base and all of those sorts of things? Did you have quarters on base or what?
I stayed. When we went to Cleveland, we were all billeted at that was the first duty station. We were billeted at a hotel, the Holiday, and that had been the sort of the transit hotel for salesmen and everything, as civilian life. And we had a good experience there. You know, we had a wave office that had been the wave office that was our boss, big boss, you know, for the waves. She had been a prison in Florida. And she ran us like we were prisoners.
In charge of the prison.
Well, I mean, she was worked in the prison.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. She was one of, and she really laid into us. She had us, she was rough. We called her the Führer. And as a matter of fact, there again, you know, you knew how far you could get, and we knew at that time, McAfee was the captain head. And, you know, well, you had to be careful. She was visiting different bases, and we were hoping she'd visit Cleveland. One of the girls had, when she came to Bloomington while we were there training, the day she came for her visit there, she had escorted her around and whatnot. And so she wrote this very nice letter, and, you know, in a nice way, how wonderful it would be if she could visit Cleveland, because we wanted to get her, and because we knew she was one that listened to the troops. She wanted you to tell her what was up, and then, and so we, but this, it was a panic, because the plane deal, the paper there, you were either studying, or you were going to classes for things, you mm-hmm. know, and whatnot, and you could, Monday night, it's sharp, but that was the only night, and you had to be in by 9 o'clock, whistling at home. You know, it was a panic. And and they the plane deal, this one, a couple of kids that used to go to this bar in Cleveland and have a few, and they're talking, how's Mark Holmes's kids these days? And she let them, they'd print the stuff up in the newspaper. But anyway, she came to visit. She did come to visit.
She did come to visit.
She did come to visit, yeah.
The
different ones that got a chance to talk to her gave her we weren't really children yet. You know, most of a lot of them. See, the maximum age at that time was 36. You couldn't be over 36. And a lot of them, the average age was 22 mm-hmm. when I went in, and I was just 22. And this, you had all these teachers that came in, and they could only take so many officers to begin, and they told them to go in the enlisted ranks, and they would later, mm-hmm. and that's what they did. My first roommate, she became a lieutenant commander, went into Supply Corps, but she had been a teacher down in Plymouth, Massachusetts. You know, the teachers were all, a lot of them little teachers, but, you know, teachers had a rough time, and, you know, they were wanting to get away from, mm-hmm. you know, because I know I lived in a small town, and we used to tackle the poor high school teachers, you know. They didn't have much freedom. Go flatten their tires on when they're out parking. Anyway, little things.
did Mildred McAfee listen to your complaints? I mean, was there? Was
oh
there
yeah, she
changes?
Listened, and we were, you know, we were careful how we got it across to her, you know, too. Like I say, the ones that we tried to get to talk to, we made sure would remember not to shoot their mouth off like they did.
Right.
Yeah.
So did any changes happen?
Yeah, a few changes did happen, yeah.
How were things different in Boston?
And not only that, but see what happened when I'm later on in the Navy, like, I'll show you the pictures after the girl that lived with me here was a shipmate. When I first knew her, and we'd tell her about this, the Fuhrer in Cleveland, you know, and then we went to a Navy reunion, you know, and of course she was there. And of course she comes up to me and grabs me, and you know, and Laura says, "That's the Fuhrer."
She aged. She got mellow.
Yeah, right. She got mellow. Yeah. Then after, she couldn't believe it, because then when I was in Washington, she used to invite us to dinner, you know, which you would never have thought that when you were in Cleveland in 1943. Like St. Patrick's Day, we organized we organized a St. Patrick's Day party. We figured we'd have a little wild party in the hotel we live in. They can't, and we had a good party. But you know, she didn't like it too well at that time. We had trouble with the hotel too. Part of it was we had to eat there. You got this amount of money, but you had to pay the hotel, and you had to eat there. Mm-hmm. And we objected to it, right? Because they were, you know, bread and water, and they were sometimes lousy food. You know, it wasn't. They were getting the money from the Navy, see, and that's what we did not, which also we got across to McAfee. Things changed a lot on that. That was one of the things.
Actually, I read her oral, when I was in New York, I had a chance to read her oral history, and she mentioned some of that she had been, I mean, in the oral history, she made a point of mentioning that there were some places, I don't think that yours was the only one.
Oh, no, I'm sure it wasn't.
But there were places that were taking advantage
of the Navy, sure.
Of the girls who were in.
Right, well, they were taking advantage of the Navy. They forced, the Navy had to pay them for not only the bedders down in the, and not only that, but they opened it, like I said, it had been a hotel for, transient hotel, really. Mm-hmm. But the section they opened up for us, a lot of them that had been closed, and, you know, you had mice running around and everything at first. It was not, you know, came out of the walls because they hadn't been used to like that, you know.
That's not good.
And we used to, what was that song? I don't get around much anymore. We used to sing that out loud at night. Don't get around much anymore.
And why is that? Why that
yeah,
song?
Well, because we couldn't, you had to be in my, anyway.
So were things different in Boston?
Oh, well, I lived there in quarters in the hotel. Then when I went to Boston, because I lived at home, I didn't live at home, but I lived out, and then we lived on Commonwealth Avenue. This rich lady, her son went into the Navy to do his bit, and so she she rented out her servants' quarters, and so the four of us all went to live at her place, which was real nice. Then we had to move in. Then they finally got a hotel, and when they got so many in, and we had wrens with us there too from England, and which was kind of interesting because they lived entirely different than we did. You know, in their rooms they had the what do you call those? Not crochet, but like crochet, the carpet, the rugs your mother used to make.
Oh yeah.
They had the rugs, and they had we went one picture on the dresser. You know, and very limited the Navy. You know, when they live ashore, the British way, when their men come ashore, they live ashore, they live like kings compared to at sea. See, so their women were the same.
So they were able to kind of decorate
their
rooms a little bit.
Yeah, they decorated more than us, yeah.
And you weren't allowed to because of the Navy.
Right, yeah. Because they was their own section, they had their rooms there. But they had that, so I had to, the four of us had to move in there. And then eventually, I lived in Auburn, and she had a stroke, and I had to move. I had to get her a place in Boston because I could only go home weekends at that time. And so I had to move her down there. So then I lived at home until she passed away in May. And see, I had was slated to go to England, but the Korean thing, the orders got changed to Hawaii. Because they needed a draft to go over and relieve the men in Hawaii to go to Korea.
So this was in the late 40s then?
Korean War was 1950s.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I was like, yeah, I didn't follow the...
Yeah, well, I didn't. Yeah, I got out of
that's okay. No, that's
out of
right.
date orders, yeah.
No, I just was trying to... So did you end up remaining in Boston the entire time of your World War II service, or did you go anywhere else?
No, when I went back in Cleveland, when I went back in 43, I stayed until 50, yeah.
In
Boston
in
area,
Boston.
Different stations in Boston. I had a lot of different I work for Navy Relief. I was their head accountant in Navy Relief there. And I worked at the Lockwood, over at the small base, and which was very interesting because we were at the start of the Howie, you know, and one day one of the German subs came up, and it was interesting, you know.
Wow.
But then I were there, and then I went to the Navy Relief, and then from the Navy Relief, I got transferred over to headquarters again and worked in the chaplain's office over there. And then I went to training aides, which took until I got orders to come out to for the Korean thing. And I had, my mother died in May, and I got those orders in August, and I had to get rid of my apartment. I had a car to get rid of, and I only had 24 hours, because I had these to spend. But my friend down in the personnel office, I said, can't you send me, I don't want to go, I need more time. She says, I'll send you on the train. I'll scratch it from the flight, say, no flights, I'll put the men on the flights, and I'll. Mm-hmm. So she put my things down at the bottom, so I had another 24 hours to then to get my aunt down. My aunt came down from Vermont, you know, to finish out while they moved the stuff up to her place from the apartment and whatnot. But I'm on the train the next night. But I call her from Chicago, and she can't find the phone in Vermont because the Navy movers are real fast, you know, and they're up there. And But then, you know, what's funny, those hours I had, and then when I get out here to San Francisco, we're sitting and waiting for, waiting for one, every morning they have this, the mustard, you know, and there's this one girl they keep calling for Thompson, no Thompson. We say, where's Thompson? And then, and of course, this is the girl who became my roommate after here. She lived in San Francisco because she didn't have to muster, see? But we were waiting for a girl that was driving from Ohio with a car, see? So the draft got held up, but it's nice it got held up because the Navy made an administrative error and we all went over on the Lurline.
And what's that?
The Lurline, mm-hmm. The Matson Line, that was this is in August, wasn't it? June Clark Gable and what's his name went over, they got married and they went over, they had there were eight of us and eight girls, Lois was one of them in the other room, in the bridal room.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty swanky.
Yeah. Oh, it was wonderful. Put on 30 pounds. eating and drinking.
On the ship over.
Yeah, right.
Oh, how
and cool. I tend to be chubby, see. I had to get rid of that boy, but oh.
Oh, how funny.
Yeah, but it was, they were one of everybody on the ship, you know. They were, you know, these, here we are, all this bunch of waves going over, you know. Oh, big old draft.
And
they were, and you know, they're always, if you get the one, here we'd had these meals, you got one thing, you know, here they try every one of the desserts, you know.
Oh, man.
Yeah, but it was a nice experience.
And this was 1950?
That was August of 1950.
Okay. How was it that you didn't end up having to leave the service?
Because I was lucky when... where was I at the end of the war? I got to think now. Where was I that I had the billet? Where the hang was I in 1946?
It would even be 1945.
I mean 1945. Yeah, I'm trying to think. About, I think I was still at. I was in the training aid section. See, at headquarters, the 12th Naval District. They took care of all the film for training at the. They were starting to set up the armories around the district, and they had to supply them, and they had training films, and it was good. That was good duty, but that's where I was. So I had a billet, see.
So, because I know a lot of the other women I've talked to, they said, well, they were just, it was all done on the point system. And so if you had so many points,
well,
you
right in. Well, they went to the separation center, right.
Yeah.
See, well, that's the ones, that's like I say, the ones went unless you had a billet. Now, see, like even Lois Thompson, this other gal here, she was a yeoman then, but the officer she had, that she'd worked for as a yeoman over here at the supply center, there was an opening for a storekeeper over in this other office, mm-hmm. And so she just changed her rate, made her a storekeeper, and so she was in a billet. That's how come she stayed.
So So she also stayed.
She also stayed, yeah.
Interesting.
She had lost it. She was back here. She left from here, but her brother was a commander of flyer, and he went down off of Hawaii. The currents in Hawaii, air currents, are very dangerous for flying over there, and he was just breaking in a new squadron, and his went down. So she had to come home because her mother was... So she had the billet, and then she was able to stay in.
So they didn't, and then at some point they realized that we need to keep some women in here because.
Well, that's why. See, that's where they realized they needed to. They were dill-dallying whether they were going to make a USN or not, and so they, while they're separating people, they passed the bill and made USN. So they had to get somebody to stay. So the people that got to stay first were the ones that had billets.
Why did you decide to stay?
Well, I thought it was a good job as long as I could stay. I loved the Navy, and I didn't want to get out. I was hoping I wouldn't have to, but and had I got out, I would have gone, and when they opened it up to USN, I would have gone down anyway. But it was good to be able to stay.
I know that a lot of the women that I talked to with have said, you know, one of the reasons that they did get out, they were kind of, you know, they may have met somebody during the war. They were kind of ready, you know.
Some of them did. And
but you, those circumstances weren't.
They weren't. That wasn't one of my problems. I was still enjoying the troops. It was good. But the one thing that was. When this Korean thing opened up and we went over and we got to the naval, going to SINCPAC fleet, which is, you know, takes SINCPAC. That's the complete. You have the Pearl Harbor, which is a receiving station, as a district, but SINCPAC fleet is the head one that runs the Pacific, the Navy in the Pacific, and SERVPAC serves them. So to see the big old admiral. And then the other admiral, the services, they put ammunition, guns. And so what I got assigned to was Area Petroleum. So when I'm telling someone to go to Area Petroleum, I said, what in the hell is Area Petroleum? All I knew about gasoline was when I was on leave when the war had started, I knew they used to get rations. You had ration tickets for gas. And in the Navy, when you went on leave during the war, they'd give you 2 red stip. You know, 2 gallons of gas there, boy, for you on leave. And so that's all I knew about air petroleum. And also at that time was when, you remember, you used to have Army, Department of the Army, Department of the Navy, and you went to Department of Defense. Remember Forrestal, the admiral that jumped out the window at Bethesda? See, so when you had the Department of Defense in these big offices at that upper, like SINCPAC fleet and SERVPAC, in those offices, you'd have an Air Force, you'd have an Army, you'd have Navy, all mixed personnel, enlisted and officer alike. Mm-hmm. In the Area Petroleum office was a Navy captain was the head, and his executive officer was the Army, and then the next one down was the Air Force officer.
So you were kind of supporting everybody.
Well, I mean, we were all working for the same purpose, but you had, and the section I worked in was the one that took care of furnishing all there's bulk of fuel, which takes care of the really heavy stuff, like, you know, cans of oil and whatnot, heavy stuff. But mine was aviation gas and the diesel, and furnished it for all the Pacific, all the planes out there and everything.
Mm. So you had to make sure it was in the right place.
Yeah, I had to make sure that there was a commander of first class and myself in the section that had to do the computations to make sure the oilers met the ships and refueled at the right place, or they wouldn't have.
Wow.
Yeah, and a lot of politics goes on. Today, what is it? I just heard something today, the big thing about squealers. But we had a situation that would have been a good one today. When I went, this Army guy, the executor, he gives me these bunch of books to read all about petroleum. So I learned about petroleum fast, and I had to make the storekeeper, and I would figure the computations of what was needed, and then see every morning when the captain went to the admirals, just like, you know, you hear the president has all these morning briefings. When they went up to the admiral, he had these charts, and see this, they used to have a chart for each, so the three grades of aviation gas, because that's when the first jets were coming in, so you had, that's a finer type of gas goes in there, you know, and then you had the diesel and whatnot, and he had a chart for each one of these, so, you know, so I couldn't be bothered doing this. I put a chart, put one chart, red for this, blue for that, green for that, colored, and I did it this one morning, see, and I had put them on his desk. Well, it was too late for him to, he couldn't make me go and do all, every one of those other charts, because they had to go up to the admiral's office. Plus, our captain, the admiral, had something for my captain. Our poor captain used to have to stand at attention at these meetings. See, the guy from the ammunition guy would be up there. They had the petroleum guy and all these other department heads, and he had to stand at attention. He was the nicest guy, a southern guy, and he'd come down, his shirt had just, you could wring it if you could have. And then the commander that I work for, he wasn't popular with the captain or any of the others, because he got sent back from Guam because he didn't drink coffee, he drank martinis, see? Late lunches, whatnot.
That could be a problem.
But he, hey, they can say what they want. He may have had those late lunches and drank those martinis, but he could, he'd check, he'd catch us if we made an error in the figures, but he wasn't popular either. Cause, but we know where the error, see, they blamed it on him, but I found out where the error. Because now Lois, when she went to the, she went to the ordnance department, but then I heard they needed a, we needed a good quick typist for the communications and messages, and I heard she was a good typist, so I maneuvered to get her down in the area of petroleum, so she was the typist for the captain and the exec, and she was the one that typed our figures that we gave to the guy and typed to make the messages. And of course, you're not supposed, when we got through, what we got through with had to go in the burn basket. But we knew something was wrong because we got picked up on something. See, one of the ships didn't rendezvous, you know, and we caught holy hell for it. You know, the commander did. Well, the commander, it wasn't wrong, and we knew because we'd each do it, and the first class would check me, and I check his figures, and the commander checked the three of things, you know, so it was a good check, double check, and so. I said to Lois, because I didn't want to put her on the ball or to give away secrets, but we had kept our figures that day. And so I said, she's talking to me, I said, when you get through with that, why don't you just lay it there? And I want to just take a quick, I said, I don't want to put you on the spot. You didn't, I'm the one that's doing it, looking where I shouldn't be looking. Because they were very tough on security in those days. You know, you and I worked together. I didn't know what you were doing. You didn't know what I was doing. Yeah, but look at the figures, and he was changing them. See that Don?
The martini drinking.
No, no, the martini. No, he. We were all right.
It was.
It's this army executive officer.
Wow.
See these figures that go into the captain. The captain look at them. Even the Navy captain. Uh-huh. See, they went in. He'd leave them going to him. Then when they came out, he changed them before Lois typed them.
Wow.
Because the captain would have picked it up.
Now, was Lois was in the year, so she was, so you're living like nearby somebody who served with you.
Well, I met her here when we're going on the Lurline, the ship, you know. I'm on the ship and I'm up there and I'm right on the rail, and then here comes this other, well, I did finally find out this Thompson that never reported in the morning that she lived in San Francisco. She was, you know, the mother. And so then that day on the ship, her mother was able to come aboard, you know, until like the same guests for the other people. And so I said, oh, well, hey, why don't you let her get up to the rail? I let her get up to the rail, the two up to the rail. So then I met Lois then, and then later, you know, that's how.
Had she been World War II as well?
Oh, yes, right.
Yeah.
She went in, see, like I say, her brother was an Annapolis guy, the commander from Annapolis, and yeah, she went in. And
now, what did your, because your mother didn't, I mean, your mother knew that you were staying in the Navy. You know, all these other girls were getting out. I'm backing up in time a little bit. But your mom, what did she think? You know, I know she didn't like that you went into the Navy, but when you decided to stay, what did she think?
Of course, she didn't know. She didn't know how it went run. She didn't know the difference then.
Oh.
See, she didn't know about, you know, the people getting out. See, she didn't know the routine, and I was still going. And
she was fine with that?
Yeah, she was fine with it. She was getting her allotment. And by then, you know, see, I had put in for allotment for her because I was supporting her. 51%, and no, she was all right then. You know,
okay.
She got over it. Yeah, but she didn't know the workings of the Navy.
Yeah.
And so then, but, you know, she knew I wanted to go overseas. Well, when the first draft went to Pearl Harbor, see, you know, after the first draft, when the war, you know, I would have loved to have gone, but I couldn't.
Because
I couldn't.
She was too sick at that point.
Well, she wasn't. She hadn't had her stroke then. It wasn't as bad. She was pretty good. She hadn't had her stroke then, but the thing is, my father died and she would have been by herself. I couldn't put myself overseas that far away.
And
I wouldn't do
far
that.
Far distance.
Yeah,
from
Boston.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not, see, it wasn't so bad in Boston for me to go home weekends, or I could even go one night during the week, but weekends was enough to go to Worcester. You know, it's mm-hmm. only 40 miles away. But I wouldn't do that to her sign mm-hmm. up, but I would love to have gone then. And Lois went over when that draft went back to Pearl Harbor. Yeah,
initial group.
She wanted to go because her brother was on. See, at that time, her brother was he was on the Helena at Pearl Harbor when it was bombed, and he was on the ship over there and he had reported. See, before the thing happened, he's duty officer at night reporting these things coming up out of the water. You know, looking at them, but. No one ever figured it was anything, you know. Mm. Those little, they had those mini subs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
See, but people, they passed a lot of stuff. They're no different then than they are now, you know. They don't,
you
see,
don't
like
know.
The, well, like the lousy intelligent, you know, everybody gets mad at Bush and everything, but they all bought the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
If your intelligence is bad, because see, later I worked in Navy intelligence too, see, that you get bad intelligence. If I give you, you rely on me, the president relies on
mm-hmm.
He's got his two of them there to rely on, and the FBI and the CIA and all the intelligence in each one of the services. You know, what are you going to do? Someone tells you this? And anyway, I'm a firm believer that they just undumped those weapons that they keep blaming them for. You know damn well. Same thing, you know, the same thing happened with the Korean thing after World War II. I learned this area petroleum, that's what I learned. They got rid of all that oils and stuff they had stashed out at Midway and whatnot, you know,
mm.
War's over. Mm-hmm. So, boom, comes Korea. And they got these planes and these ships they got to get out there. No oil there. Pearl Harbor was the closest, see? See, so they did the same thing happens every
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really learn from our
past.
No, we don't, even ourselves, all things we do.
Mm. How long did you end up staying in Hawaii?
Well, that one I stayed there from went there to 50 to 52,
mm-hmm.
and there again while I was there, see, they were having this because the Korean War was still on, see,
mm-hmm.
and we went there in 52, and the thing is coming out. Boy, they're looking. They need people to push boots at the training thing, see. So we've been there long enough. Everything, see. Well, we'll put in for there. And we'll go home earlier, see. We've seen Hawaii now, and. Kidding, see, and I was master arms away barracks, so I could do this during the day. So I put the four of us that ran around together, I put the four names, and I sent the four names and volunteered them. And so any sucker that put in, you were sure to get duty there. Of course, you didn't get it when we didn't go the next month.
Mm-hmm.
When our tour was up, all four of us went. Well, later at a reunion, I said to the yeoman that was the detailed yeoman, I said, hey, I said, how many was on that? Remember when you were looking for recruit trainers at Bainbridge, I said, hey, how many did you have on that list? She said, four.
So you all ended up in Bainbridge.
Yeah, and Lois, when she found out you got to go to instructor school first, because you might end up being a teacher rather than a push the boots. And oh, boy, I wasn't too popular. One of the other girls, though, made officer. She was the one that you saw a lot, that real attractive one you saw in uniform a lot. She,
mm-hmm.
Joan Mackey. She had cancer and died young. But the other two of us, we just plodded along.
So when you say push boots, what does that mean?
Well, a boot, they call it pushing boots from recruit training. You're pushing the boots, see. You have a company, you have about 40 recruits in a company, and you pick out a shop, which one you think looks pretty sharp, and you make her the commander of there,
mm-hmm.
see, to deal with you. She has to take care of them when you're not with them. And then they have the group that were instructors teaching them all the different stuff. And then the one that taught them swimming, that one, and the instructors. So you were either pushing boots or you were, but everyone, they can consider push. Well, Lois ended up, she pushed one company, but she ended up volunteered. They needed, the girl in uniforming was being transferred, and so she She went volunteered for that job. She didn't care.
As what?
To be uniforming. She uniformed all the.
Oh, so she would give them their, make sure that they were measured.
She got them
way.
Right, that they fitted them and make sure that everything, yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah. And you continued to do the
business. I only pushed one company, but then I got picked to be a regimental adjutant. See, there were two commanders in the regiment that ran them, and the one I got to be the regimental adjutant for her. And then
when, what is a regimental adjutant?
The head chief of the two things.
So you're one of the two.
Yeah, like see when they got when they whatever paperwork between the two see the recruits go so many weeks, then they get this on training.
Mm-hmm.
That 11th week they have, and I had to plot what they were going to sign them to, what their detail was for that.
Figure out what they
time.
Were
yeah, and anything. Yeah, anything to any of the. To anything that the military part that would come down from the command, the wave commander
mm-hmm.
of the.
Because at this point, it's still waves. It's still not part of the U.S. Navy.
Oh, no, we're still waves. We're waves.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, you're part of the U.S. Navy, but you're not.
No, we're USN, but not. We hadn't got this integrated stuff thing. Yeah.
Yet,
we were
yeah.
USN. We weren't reserves anymore. We were USN, but you waves were waves and not.
Mm-hmm.
They had their the head one in Washington, a wave, a commander, a captain. They were captain by then running the waves.
Mm-hmm.
And in each one of the districts, they had a wave officer that was the district wave commander to take care of any problems with the waves, the officers, you know, and it would contact them.
So is that what you continue to do, or did you move on to other work in the Navy?
Well, I mean, after recruit training, see, like I say, anyone that volunteered for that got it. Well, then the needs of the Navy always come first, but then that was considered pretty rough duty because you were, you know, you were nothing, that's all you lived and died. If you were an instructor, you know, our buddies that were instructors, all they did is complain, hey, that recruit of yours, see? So we, you know, you were like mothers
mm-hmm.
to these kids. So they considered, you know, you needed to get out. And so the choice, so we went back to Hawaii. See, I didn't care too much for the first tour, but the second tour, I loved it.
Really?
I mean, yeah, right. I felt confined. I felt confined the first time.
Is that because the war was on, do you think?
No. Just that it was only 105 miles around that damn island. You know, it was only 100, I could go from Boston to New York. You know, so we used to do that. We were over there. We run around on the island twice, and we said we've been Boston to New York on a Sunday. No, I didn't enjoy it as much. I liked it, but I didn't enjoy it as much as the second tour.
What was so much better about the second tour?
I guess because my attitude. I mean, just I don't know why it was better. It was like I say, the first one. I enjoyed being master arms of the barracks and everything. That part I'd enjoyed, but I just felt it was confining.
Mm-hmm. So how long how long were you there for your second tour?
And then I went back and we went back and I went 52 to 55. Went back 3 years. And then when I retired from there, we used to go over every Christmas.
Did you retire after being in Hawaii or did you go?
Oh, well, no, I retired back here at the Schools Command in Treasure Island.
So you ended up back in San Francisco?
Oh, well, yeah, see, after Hawaii, that second tour to Hawaii. See, Lois and I were friends and then lived together and were buddies and whatnot. And we put in to go to any dumbbell that had asked for Washington would get Washington. Of course, she'd been there early. Her first duty station was Washington. But anyway, we went to, so of course, we got Washington. US. And then that's where I went to Naval Intelligence. And Naval Intelligence, then I went up to Bupers on the, you know, from the Korean War, they had problems with you didn't have as many men try to escape as during World War II and whatnot. So they had what they called leadership teams going around the men to around the Navy
mm-hmm.
to remind them that not only your service number, but probably General Order 17 and whatnot. To you know that
what's General Order 17?
Oh, I can't remember it now. But it's you know that in the Navy, the purpose of the Navy. You know, it's one of those things. You know, you should be. They were their attitude. Say they were. What was that word they used? Then they were, you know. They
comportment?
It wasn't a comportment. They disinterested, and I can't think of the word right now. Well,
okay.
that they felt they didn't. They needed to be jolted, and so went around all these and tried to say it. And I was saying it was a postgraduate boot camp thing, mm-hmm. type of thing, mm-hmm. is what it was. And so they had one for the waves. Yeah, because how I got picked for that, I went to one of these. They had one of these meetings, and the chaplain that run was head of the working on the leadership team. As a matter of fact, he was the Cardinal O'Connor in New York. Eventually, you remember him, mm-hmm. the last guy, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that was an experience. So anyway, you know, they had this meeting, and so I get up there and show my mouth. I want to know, what do they teach them at boot camp these days? The way they add their attitude when they get out, you know. Well, that was a. I want to get her. We'll let you know how they teach them. So that's what I got pulled for that duty. My name, quick, they found out what my name was there. And I'm so out of Navy intelligence, I'm up to the Bupers leadership team for waves. There were three of us. Then we went around to the different bases, mm-hmm. to. And they had problems with the, you had some of these captains were, you know, like one Patuxent was the captain would require them to be in full dress uniform when they went to do the laundry in the laundry room in the barracks.
Oh, jeez.
You know, stupid damn stuff like that. And the wave officer that went on the leadership team of this, of course, she was pushing to be up in that number one spot, but she, the officers wouldn't speak up, see, but I never miss an opportunity. See, and I said to this one captain, I said, your wife goes out shopping in the afternoon, and she goes around, and she's pretty damn tired, and what's the first thing she does when she comes home? She takes her girdle off. Well, what's the wave off is, of course, she's... Yeah, they were able to get rid of their uniforms and go to the laundry and...
That's probably a good thing.
Yeah, well, he probably never thought of it.
Probably didn't.
See? But I figured, bring it home to him. I'm sure his wife would... He probably went home and told us when that fresh chief said, and he probably said, do you take your girdle off when you come home?
And she probably said yes.
It's hot in Pax River.
So what did you have any other duties that you did for the Navy while you were with the Navy before you retired?
Let's see, okay, so I went to the leadership team. Mm-hmm. And after the leadership team and that, there again, the needs of the Navy first, but I had, you know, a couple of inns around the bureau then, and so I said, okay, I want to go to Hawaii, you know, because I'm coming down to premiere my last tour pretty soon. So I got to come back out to, went back out to Hawaii.
So you did three tours in Hawaii. Mm. Very nice.
That was the second tour.
That was the second tour.
That was the second tour. No, okay. I only did two tours.
Okay.
In Hawaii. That was the second tour, and that I really, really enjoyed. And then I went to out there that time. I got sent to the commissary store because I was a storekeeper still. Mm-hmm. And all along the way, every time I went, I was a storekeeper in all these jobs, but I really ended up more as an administrator, which should have been a yeoman's, which is a yeoman's, mm-hmm. in their category more than storekeeper. Storekeeper's supposed to be out in the storeroom counting and, or, mm-hmm. you know. So and not only that, but then they were opening up overseas billets, and there weren't very many for storekeepers, and I was hoping to get that back that I was going to go to London that time. And so anyway, I put in to change my rate. And so from the commissary store, I was at the commissary for about a year, and they put in, they sent me back to San Diego. To change my rate, and then when I finished the school there and back to Hawaii, of course you return to your duty station because they just sent me to change the rate. When I got back there, I work in the commissary store, but that's part of the naval station. It's one of their things. And so when I came back, they're the ones that paid the bill to send me to school, and that I'd come back. And right, so when I came back, personnel officer at the receiving station said, I don't want to send you back to the commissary. Maggie, I'd like you to do me a favor. Would you do me a favor? I said, well, I have to, don't I? You sent me to yeoman school. He's a nice guy. And he says, there's a captain, I'm having trouble to keep a yeoman. He can't keep a yeoman. He's been through three yeomen, male yeomen, he says. So I thought, maybe, would you go down? He's kind of a crabby old guy, but why don't you go down? I said, sure, I'll go down. And, I'll give it a try, you know. Well, he wasn't, he was funny. It was funny because, See, there was the commander sat out, the commander and I sat outside the captain's office, and then it was the room where all the mail would come in and be put in the pukas and whatnot. And they have swinging doors over there because of the weather, you know. And they have a, they had a bus that the officers, most of them lived up on the, up with St. Patrick Street, because that was a nice area, the officers' homes up there. And so they had this jitney that took them up for about, from the 14th Naval District headquarters there. So, you know, when the captain came in the morning, I'd say, "Good morning, Captain." He'd push, go into his office, not say a word, see. And then, and at night, and I, he'd go out, you know, and if I went there, and I'm pushing mail this one night, I'm doing the mail, and he went out, and I went out, I went all the way out, and he's down getting in the thing, and I'm saying, "Night, Captain," and all the other captains are there. So say nothing, see. And so then, one day I'm around, and I'm just going through the to the next office, and he's leaving, and he says, "Good night, Maggie." He was funny. He was nice. He was nice. So he was a, well, the mail chief, the poor mail chief in this other office I was going to, he said, he never speaks to him. He goes, "Well, he wasn't well, actually, too. We didn't know it then. But anyway, he'd go through there and not even speak to any of them, see?" And the poor commander that's sitting there, he wondered, "What's this thing? Good night, Maggie." And this commander had a wife that had, he had kids, but he had a wife that, you know, anything had happened, she'd call him, he'd have to take the kids, got to go to the dispensary. Well, we're having these little war games that you'd have every once in a while. And so we're on this phase three, and we're up in the, he's up in the cane fields and whatnot, and his wife's calling, "Scraped his knee," and he's scraping his knee. And I said, "You know the command, the commander's not here." I said, "Why don't you just take some good, nice soapy water, wipe it off. Do you got any mercurochrome? Put some mercurochrome on there. Put a Band-Aid on there, and he'll be all right." So I thought, oh, God, she's going to, the next day I kept thinking of the commander's going to come in, and the commander, he was a nice guy, but he was very protective of me. He was, you know, he's afraid. I'll tell you a funny story now. I don't know if you want to go there. They were having trouble, all of a sudden we're having a lot of trouble with VD. So we're to find out what's spreading it, where is it being spread. And see, my captain was the head of the HASP, which is the Hawaiian Armed Services Police. Each one takes their turn. He had it. So they got to go down, and they're doing all the stuff and trying to find out. And they finally found out it was in the tattoo shops. So we, and we had, because we had, they had this one case that they were pushing, see, in the sailor, and they had, and of course the chief on the other side, he'd already called over in the office, the personnel section was part of ours, had already called me over, and I'd already seen the pictures and everything. But anyway, this guy had a, he had a butterfly tattooed on his penis. Now you know how loaded that guy had to be.
Oh my goodness.
Because out in that area, you know, that's,
yeah.
Anyway, see, I'm giving thanks to the, and the commander's over here in the drawer. He doesn't want to protect me, you know. And so he takes the envelope into the captain, and I'm killing myself laughing. But but anyway, that's what. So then they had to paint the tattoo shops over, you know, get them cleaned up and paint them. And I don't know, let's get with the needles or what. I don't know why they thought. But anyway, that was coming from the tattoo shops.
Wow.
Kind of quieted down. But see, little things like that. Anyway, but I often thought, that guy, couldn't think, what ever happened to that guy?
Yeah. And did he?
I don't know whatever happened to him. I say,
no.
See, all I could think of him, I'm going to tell you a funny story from high school. I went to this small high school, you know, there were only 400 people in the whole school, 4 years. Anyway, this one kid, he ate ate peanut butter and marshmallow sandwiches every noon for 4 years. And he always had this little white, remember that, it came in a can, that cream marshmallow, loved it. And he had this little white line from the marshmallow every day. And I went to class reunions the 10th and 15th, and every time I see the guy, I said, "That's what happened, you're not eating no marshmallow lately." And all I could think of, I'd think of someone knew this guy, wouldn't you, like, say, "How's the butterfly?"
Oh. Oh, dear. Yeah, that would just, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, you just can't imagine it.
No. So did you retire after Hawaii, or did you?
So, okay, in Hawaii, I left Hawaii in 58. See, that second tour of Hawaii, I went from there. That's when I went to Washington.
Okay.
See, and then from Washington, I came out here. See, when I came through here in 1950, I thought, boy, I'd love to have duty here in San Francisco. Because to me, this is New England at its best. Nice, cool club, not too hot, not too, the perfect part of New England. See. And I thought, so it took me 11 years to get it. So there again, Washington duty was tough, and I knew the yeoman, and so we got, both of us got transferred out here. And that's where I finished my tour out here. And I went to the section to retire officers in the 12th Naval District Headquarters on Treasure Island. And then from there, I went, was sent over to the school's command, the electronics, and that, and that's where I retired.
That's, I mean, it's pretty...
And I lived in the barracks there until...
You lived in the barracks?
Well, I know. I lived ashore until we decided when we retired, so you could put your papers in a year ahead of time. We decided we're going to retire, and after we retire, we're going to... We went on leave to Europe in 54, and we wanted to go back. So we said, when we retire, we'll... So we, you know, we were hacking the money away every month, and so we put in to move back in the barracks to save the rent money. Because rent was heavy and whatnot. And so I lived in the barracks at Treasure Island. It was a nice barracks, too.
And this, did your friend who lives here retire at the same time?
Yes. We both, we retired together, and we went to Europe for 8 months.
Wow.
And the first time we went over in 1954, we just went ahead 30-day leave. And that, and I had a shipmate from Boston that was over there. She was... Her mother was a French war bride from World War One. See, and her father stayed over there. Mary was born in Paris, but her father stood up for 7 years, and he said, "You gotta come with me to the U.S." And so, and so that's so. Mary spoke, of course, she spoke good French, but it was funny because in high school, this high school teacher told she'd never learned French.
She spoke it for a while.
She Parisian French. She could read it and write it and speak it, and yeah, she'd kill herself laughing every time. She said, no, the high school teacher told me I'm not going to learn French. She became a warrant officer. She was a nice gal.
Did you know? Did you ever feel that you missed out on anything by staying in the Navy?
No.
No.
No, I'd do it over again.
Yeah.
No, I didn't miss out on anything. See, back at the time, you would have got married like the time I would have got married. But depression. You either went and lived in his family or he lived with your family. That was a bunch of... And I wasn't ready to settle down anyway. I wanted to travel. I wouldn't. So that was mainly why I didn't... and probably why I said, I'll join the Navy. See the sea?
Yeah. Although,
but, yeah. But no, I say that...
It's just, it was an unusual career path. It was an unusual path for a woman to take of that of your era, of your generation.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, because like I said...
Well, yeah, at 25, if you didn't get married, you were an old maid.
Exactly.
Right? And now, like in my class, you know, see, there were 78 of us in the class, and in a small town, it's funny, I was able to go to the 55th reunion. They have, a lot of them stayed in the town and married, you know, went to the classmates, married, and... stayed, and a bunch of us, a few of us left, but most of them stayed in the area. Was the thing to do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you never had the desire to get married and have children.
No.
Yeah.
No, marriage didn't. I didn't, I'll tell you, I was selfish. I'll be perfectly honest, I was selfish. If I was going to work and earn it, I was going to spend it the way I wanted. I want someone to tell me how to spend it. You know, I had a couple of boyfriends tell you they wanted you to dress. That's a bunch of... They wouldn't even tell me. You know, that's...
How do you think, I mean...
I went, see, you know, the good Lord knows there's them that'll be good, and I probably wouldn't last it long either, see. Well, that's what I used to tell this one, the one guy that I was going to marry. Because that's, I wanted to be a lawyer. I was going to go to law school, see. I was going to go to Porsche's Law School in Boston, send the papers in. I kept telling him, I'm going because I want to know how to get a divorce if I marry you.
That's not going into a marriage with a broken attitude.
No, that's not the right attitude. He was a nice guy, but he was the guy, he was going to stay. God, he, you know, he only left, I don't think he didn't leave Massachusetts. I think he might have gone down to Connecticut or Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
It's only because he stumbled on it. He didn't know the difference. Until he had a son went in the service and was stationed in the Air Force out in North Dakota, and the only way he could see him was to go. See, so that wasn't me. No, I'm going to stay in one place. But he was a very nice guy. It have made a wonderful husband and father, but not for me.
How do you think that you ended up getting that sort of kind of, I mean, it's because it's a different, it's an independent streak.
Well, independent, you know, I've thought of this more in the late, like they say, you think of all these things in your old age. I had decided that part of my problem, my problem is, see, there's a lot to be said for those nurturing years of the baby. The mother coddles or your loving thing. I didn't get any of that loving. I was in the orphanage, and as a, you know, then mm-hmm. you're lucky they didn't always change your damn britches.
Mm-hmm.
The poor people, that took them a week after they got me, I was adopted. I was so bound up. But anyway, I think that had I've always thought maybe that had a lot to do with it. You just didn't have that little bit of something in you that you needed
mm-hmm.
to.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense.
That, and of course, being the only one in the family, when you're adopting, you're the only one in the family. I wasn't a loner that I stayed to myself, but I mean, you didn't have, I thought the Navy was wonderful. I had those 592 sisters when I went to Bloomington. Wonderful. You know, to me, it was a great experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the combination of, sort of left alone when you were born and then being the only one, and because it's helped me now, because as much as I love to travel and everything, which I can't do now, but I even surprised myself that it doesn't bother me staying alone or a day I don't want. Now I have a neighbor that if she has to stay in the house a day, 2 days, because she's climbing the walls, you know, it doesn't bother me. I can find, I'm not, never get bored. I don't know what
mm-hmm.
bored is. Find something to do, even as bad as the eye. And we both, she's as blind as I am, both have the same thing. She's a little worse off. But I had to adjust to the magnifying glass. You adjust. You like to read, you're going to, whatever way you're going to do it, either get the things and listen or get the magnifying glass. You have to adjust to whatever it's been given you.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think I do that better than, and maybe it's all part of that being alone a lot.
Well, it sounds
See, like when you were the only child, you had to fend for yourself and think of things to do, because your mother and father were playing with you. Although my stepfather was wonderful, I had him going real good, because I wasn't too good in school. What I mean, I wasn't too good behaved in school. I was always getting in trouble, see? And I was having to have these notes from my parents, you know. See, my mother's thing is, if you get disciplined, I was stupid. I used to take this envelope every year to the teacher. My mother gave me this, take to school the first day of school, and I didn't give it to the teacher. So like a smart one, what the... A kid I'm going to school with this day, I said, I wonder what the hell's in this envelope I take all the time. You know, my mother's telling, you can discipline her in any way that makes your job easier. And I've been taking this to the teachers, no wonder I was kidding.
Well, but you've also, in your life, you've also had, I mean, it sounds like you've had your friends, you know, you have, there's the one woman who you served with, and it sounds like the two of you became very close friends, and also had that.
Right, and okay, now I'll even tell you one better, because see, there were three of us lived here together, from 71 together. When I retired from the Navy.
And did you move here when you retired?
No, when I retired from the Navy, I went back to Massachusetts, and because I had looked up my natural mother, so I had contact back there, but she lived in Boston, and because I had been in Worcester with all my high school friends were there in Auburn and whatnot. Well, my high school teacher, commercial high school teacher, she had an apartment, and she said, "Hey, why don't you move in with me? I could stand a roommate for a while. You know, I'd like someone," and so I moved in with her, and that's what I did. While I stayed back there, and I would have only stayed the first year. I would have shoveled that snow 1 year, and I would have known I'm not shoveling this crap anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get it shoveled out, and then someone else puts their car in the spot.
Mm-hmm.
Or you get it all shoveled out, and the plow comes up and puts it all on your car again. Anyway, but she'd had a kind of rough life. She had a mother and father that both ended, her father ended up a vegetable, and her mother had time, and she was taken, and now I think, of course, I caused her a lot of problems, because she was, this is her teaching days,
mm-hmm.
that she had to teach and go home and take care of those two people that were bedridden, you know, because her brother had got married and left home, you know, and her sister. So she was the one, the youngest one, and she got the burden of teaching. And so she had it rough. And so I thought, when you get ready to retire, and she's coming up to getting it done, and she ought to do something different. Come on out to San Francisco with me. So I stayed, because I knew if I didn't stay in a couple of years, she would never have made the move by herself, you know, because she said, New Englanders can put their head in the sand, you know, we had a tendency to do that. That was part of why my first tour in Hawaii didn't work out as good. Some of the stuff, see, learned that lesson. Get the head the hell out of the sand.
The cranky Yankee thing.
Yeah, right. So I knew she wouldn't make the move by herself, give up her partner, and pushed her. And so I brought her out. And I said, come out, if you like it, okay. If you don't, you can come back. I said, I probably won't come back with you, but you can come back. Mm-hmm. No, it was the understanding. So anyway, she came out, and we came out in 71, and she went back in 96. So.
Wow.
So she enjoyed her stuff, and she, you know, we... little much better, different life than she would have had.
Mm-hmm.
Needed a break.
Because
she had an aunt, after her mother and father died and whatnot, she had an aunt that was an ex-teacher, and she had to take care of her because she was in the rest home and problems. Mm-hmm. So it sometimes...
Well, I'm sure, yeah, like I said, having the friends and having the companionship also, it's not as it, you know, it, that's probably also, it helps.
Yeah. Right. See, and it was just like when I went in the Navy. I thought, you know, your worst roommates were ones that came from large families.
Really?
Well, yeah. See, because they had to share all the time, and see, they got the space boy, and boy, you better not even come 1 inch into their space now, you know. And the men were just as bad. Oh, yeah. This one little chief, he was so funny. Called in during the Korean thing and out at Pearl, and he came in the morning and he'd crouches all get out, and he's like, I said, what's the matter? I said, what's the matter, Chief? What's the matter with you? He says, that guy that shares a locker next to me, he says, he's always got his damn locker door over in my space. I said, well, what you doing in your space? He said, none, it's just the principle of the thing. Just like old ladies. I used to tell them, they were weren't the men, you know. Like I said, I always let them have their time to themselves, and then I had a lot of fun with them, too. But, you know, men time, and right. And anyway, I can tell you, you guys are worse gossips than any woman. Don't ever tell me your wife gossips. You guys are worse than any woman ever was. And they are.
Is it just Navy men, or do you think it is?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I never had enough of the other all in one group together to know. Well, these Navy guys. They were nice.
Oh,
they were good guys.
Well, I can't think of any other questions that I have to ask. I mean, you know, I don't know if you have anything you feel like you want to add. We've been at this for quite some time.
Yeah, what time is it? Oh, it's 7 o'clock.
I know, we've had almost 2 hours of tape here. So I'm going to stop this.